Hello, I'm Richard Suchet, and this is the LBC Daily Debrief, the podcast that brings you the full story on the day's biggest news. And we start with the campaign to make upskirting a sexual offence. There's no ban in place at the moment. We'll speak to a professor of law who's trying to change that. Plus,
we want a healthy and beautiful countryside, producing food that makes us healthier as individuals in a society which has a healthier attitude towards the natural world, an attitude that values permanence.
Michael Gove has been setting out his vision for the future of farming. Don't switch off. It's much more interesting than it sounds. And we've sent our reporter to get the farmer's verdict. Plus, we'll speak to the Cambridge researchers who think they found a cure for fake news. Now, it looks like the government has ruled out creating a new law to ban upskirting. That's despite widespread calls for new rules to protect victims. There currently isn't a ban in place, which is especially worrying when new figures show children as young as 10 have had photos taken under dresses and skirts without their consent. But the Ministry of Justice says there doesn't need to be a change because existing laws can be used as an avenue for prosecution. So how widespread is this issue? Let's get more on this now from Professor of Law at Durham University and an expert on sexual violence, Claire McGlynn. Good to speak to you, Claire. Just how widespread is this issue?
It's difficult to be definitive because this isn't the kind of thing that any government or other body keeps statistics on. What we do know from stories in the press and in the media over the last number of months that this is happening very regularly to many women and, in fact, many girls in schools. More and more are coming to speak out about it. And undoubtedly, it's a growing phenomenon in light of, you know, the ubiquity of smartphones and such technology.
I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but what can the impact on victims be?
Well, victims talk about, you know, feeling violated and feeling that their personal space has been infringed. So they're out in public having a good time at a festival. They might be doing their shopping. They're on the underground. They're in McDonald's restaurants. And they realise that someone is taking images up their skirts without their consent. And, yeah, it infringes on their daily lives. It can leave them feeling humiliated. And sometimes, of course, these images are then put up on websites, so then they're very difficult to get taken down. And these are private images, then are shared widely on the internet.
And is there a typical perpetrator? Is there an age group or a type that is most likely to perpetrate that kind of crime?
I don't think there is a typical perpetrator. What we know from the Freedom of Information statistics revealed today is that perpetrators range across the ages, from, you know, teenagers right up to into their 50s and 60s. I think what we probably do need to think about is when laws on voyeurism were first adopted in 2003, people thought about peeping Toms as sorts of oddities and perverts that needed psychological treatment. I think what we know now from the use of smartphones and social media is people are taking upskirting images for a whole range of reasons. It might be to cause distress and humiliation. It might be for financial gain, for a laugh, but also for sexual gratification. So that's why it's not just one type of perpetrator.
The government say there's already legal avenues in place. You mentioned voyeurism, but there's also kind of public order laws and public decency laws. It seems pretty reasonable to say that those laws exist and can be used as an avenue for prosecution. Is that an argument that you accept?
They can be used. That's right. There's an offence called outraging public decency, and it has been used to prosecute some people for upskirting. The problem is that it doesn't cover all situations of upskirting. It only covers some of them. It also is not classified as a sexual offence, which means someone coming forward to the police doesn't get anonymity like they would if they were reporting other sexual offences. So that means their name could be used in the press, which is likely to lead to more people viewing the image. And victims also tell me, one victim said to me that this offence of outraging public decency doesn't match up to her experiences. That's the offence is about harm to the public, whereas in fact this was about harm to her.
All right. Professor of Law at Durham University, Claire McGlynn, thanks very much for joining us here on the LBC Daily Debrief. Now, coming up...
Can you stay categorical? You are fake news.
Yes, once again, we're looking at the world of fake news, but it could be about to become a thing of the past. Researchers at Cambridge think they found a cure by turning it into a game. We'll speak to the man behind it all in just a few moments. But first, Michael Gove has been setting out his vision for agriculture post-Brexit. The Environment Secretary has been speaking at the National Farmers Union annual conference today. His appointment raised eyebrows when it was first announced. The former journalist, Secretary of State for Education and Justice Secretary didn't seem like the most natural fit. But since starting in June last year, he's become something of an eco-warrior, pushing a number of green policies. But has Michael Gove done enough to get the seal of approval from farmers? The LBC Daily Debrief's Hannah Griffiths has been at the NFU conference, lucky girl, to see how Michael Gove's gone down.
It was a warm but not overly enthusiastic welcome from the farmers at the NFU conference here at the ICC in Birmingham.
Conference, please give the Secretary of State, Mr. Michael Gove, a very warm welcome.
The speech does come amid concerns about the barriers to trade and the free movement of labour after Brexit that could hit farmers hard. It's estimated it could cost the agriculture and the food sector £110 billion a year. But Mr. Gove promised putting farmers first in Brexit was top of his priority.
For the first time in almost half a century, we are free to design policies from first principles that put British farmers and consumers first.
Popular in the hall was his promise for a review of farm inspections.
We will be conducting a thorough and comprehensive review of the inspection regime, and our aim will be to simplify.
But outside the conference, the farmers told me they weren't holding their breath over that promise.
I'm actually fed up of hearing that. We've had, over the last 20 years, we've probably had half a dozen of those reviews that have resulted in very little benefit to the farmers.
We've heard it before. They need to deliver.
We've heard it many times before. How you can actually drill it down to one inspection, as he's saying, is very difficult because there are so many associated standards.
It was certainly something to put in front of 1,000 farmers and say, that's what we'll do. But we've heard it from many ministers before and we've yet to see the evidence on the ground.
Also popular was talk of the rollout of superfast broadband to rural areas. Not a new policy, but it hit a nerve with many.
The broadband provision is so patchy and poor in so many areas. It is ridiculous that you can get better mobile phone coverage in Kenya than in parts of Kent.
Currently where I am, I don't have broadband of any speed, so yes, it'd be excellent if that does come through. And phone signal, more importantly.
At home, we run at 0.2 of a megabyte, which is horrendous. It grinds to a halt at lunchtime. You know, doing the online banking, it drops out more times than it stays live.
So overall, what did farmers think of Mr. Gove's speech and his time in the job so far?
There was a lot of promises we'll get back to yous, but not a lot else other than that. So, in all, a little non-committal, I would say.
A lot of interesting things that he mentions, but absolutely zero substance, which is a shame. He knew he was coming here today. It's a shame he couldn't have just announced one fact.
He's raising the profile. Got to deliver on the goods.
You know, when you're coming to speak to 1,000 farmers, you should have something up your sleeve to announce. I believe he did have something to announce, and I think he was probably sat on from on high.
That's the LBC Daily Debrief's Hannah Griffiths reporting there. And finally, fake news is many things. It's an insult, a play, a movie, and for some, an entire industry. It was even the Collins Dictionary word of 2017, and now it's being turned into a game. Cambridge researchers have built an online game called Bad News, where players compete to become a disinformation and fake news tycoon. By showing how it works, they hope the game will vaccinate the public, making people immune to the spread of misinformation. Well, it's an interesting idea, and on the line now is the man behind it all, director of the Cambridge Social Decision-Making Lab, Sander van der Linden. Good to speak to you, Sander. Just talk us through how this game works.
Yeah, great to be on the show. The game itself, as you said, really lets players step into the shoes of a fake news producer. And so the theory behind it is really that, you know, once you've seen the magic trick, you won't be fooled by it again. And there are badges you can earn throughout the game. And so these are based on research. And so there's different kinds of badges. And once you've collected them all, you sort of get your fake news certificate at the end.
You know, I'm of the generation of Tetris and Super Mario. Games have come a long way, haven't they? Why did you decide to start looking into this vaccine for fake news?
Yeah, that's a great question. So last year around this time, we did a study That was also described as a vaccine, but that was really much more passive. So we asked people to read articles, essentially trying to inoculate people against a full story that was entirely fabricated. But two things really flew out or came out of that discussion. One was, well, that study was about climate change specifically, and we're wondering, well, is there a way to confer general immunity against fake news? And one of the ways that we envisioned doing that is to actually let people master the techniques themselves, so that, you know, that's probably the best way to really understand on a deeper level some of the techniques that are being employed, rather than having to tailor the sort of vaccines to specific content for every specific news story. So we thought it would be much more effective to try to do this on a much larger scale. And the other is really that, you know, reading stuff is very passive. So we thought maybe we can make it more interactive and sort of educational experience for people. Also because the way human memory works and the way we remember things and how concepts are associated, if you're interactively playing something, there's a much, you know, greater likelihood that you'll learn and remember something.
How are you going to evaluate and measure the game's success?
Yeah, so we have a survey built into the game. And so for anyone who's interested in participating in scientific research, they can voluntarily sign up. And then essentially we'll look at people's ability to discern fake from real news, and, you know, how reliable people think certain headlines or certain messages are at the beginning of the game as well as at the end of the game. And then hopefully what we hope to see is that people have improved in their ability to spot fake news, to deem it less reliable, and to have some immunity against these tactics at the end of the game.
Well, as all parents know, and I'm one of them, you give your child a vaccination and they can develop the very symptoms of the disease you're trying to protect against. What's to say you won't turn more people into purveyors of fake news and untruths?
Yeah, we get that question a lot, and it's a really interesting
Sorry,
one.
Obvious think, question then.
Perhaps not obvious, but it's a concern for many people. And I think at least the way that we think about it is that, one, those groups and individuals who are sort of ill-intended and are thinking of doing this already, you know these techniques. They've already mastered them. They already have the Russian sort of troll farm going. And for the people who are aspiring to become a real fake news artist, they often have pre-existing motivations. Sometimes they're monetary, sometimes they're political. And I'm not sure if the game would really inspire that in people. And so we're sort of left with a small percentage of people who could, you know, who've played this game for the first time and then realized they could do this for real. I mean, we can't say with any certainty that won't happen. But I think the benefit of potentially familiarizing millions of people with this weighs up against the risk of a few people going rogue and actually starting to produce fake news. At least that's our hope.
There's no fake news here, Sander, I assure you. Thanks very much for joining us. That's the director of the Cambridge Social Decision-Making Lab, Sander van der Linden there. And that is your LBC Daily Debrief for today. I'm Richard Suchet, and we'll be back to give you the full story on the day's biggest news tomorrow. In the meantime, make sure to hit subscribe so that you never miss your daily update. And if you've enjoyed today's programme, please do leave us a review. But of course, the real news doesn't stop with this podcast. Make sure you listen to LBC on digital radio, FM in London, or online at lbc.co.uk. And I'll speak to you tomorrow.